Since 1970, the United States has conducted population inventories every 10 years. Traditionally, minority groups have been undercounted, resulting in loss of revenue-sharing funds, educational and housing benefits, and a place in the great computer. This year, special efforts are being made to obtain a 100% accounting of what demographers expect to be some 222 million Americans. One aspect of that effort is reflected in the hiring of extra staff to handle minority enumeration, or census-taking. And another is the extra census, called the early census, that begins tomorrow in rural Alaska. Ruth Okitkin is the field operations assistant in charge of census-taking in the 50 villages and settlements in the Arctic Slope and Doyon regions of the state. She explains why Alaska is receiving special treatment.
They made a concession for Alaska because of difficulties in springtime, especially in the rural areas where there's breakup and it's hard to get into and out of the village. And some people in the villages start going to their fishing camps or construction camps and stuff like that. So they decided to have an early census date for Alaska.
Was this the first time that this happened?
I believe so.
In the winter, we've got different problems than in the springtime. Springtime, there's breakup, but in the winter, you can get weathered in or weathered out.
Right. I'm very well aware of that. a lot of the census takers have asked me, why are you taking the census in the coldest part of the year? But it was a matter of the Census Bureau met with many Native corporations in Alaska, with the governor of Alaska, and different organizations in Alaska, and they decide upon an early census date.
Weather isn't the only problem confronting rural census takers. In some cases, they'll have to locate people at trapping camps, translate questions, and cajole suspicious folks into becoming statistics. For example, small communities everywhere are torn by factionalism. With only one enumerator per village, I wondered about the reluctance on the part of members of one side to cooperate with someone from the other group, particularly on personal matters.
I'm sure we'll have a problem in some, with some people on that. I'm sure there are a lot of people that want to keep their privacy to themselves and not give out personal information. But we'll try to convince them that it's for their benefit.
Besides housing, employment, health, educational, and senior citizen benefits, there's the personal advantage of being able to obtain data from the computer to get proof of age for Social Security benefits, driver's licenses, and passports. And of course, if people refuse to fill out their forms, their community could lose out on those available funds. There are two census forms, a short one and a long one. In rural Alaska, half of the respondents will be asked to complete the short form, and the other half will get the long one. But in cities, only 1 in 6 people will receive the long form, which takes approximately 45 minutes to complete. Questions are about population and housing. The short form has 7 questions about each person, while the long form has 33. And regardless of form, there's only room for 7 children. That could be a problem for many large rural families. And the same form will be administered to all Americans, regardless of location or lifestyle.
The housing questions include, is this a condominium, or is this a one-family house, or how many apartments are there in this building? Also about utility cost, and there are questions about energy use, whether you have a truck or a van, and how do you get to work, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I think especially now, mistrust government intervention into private lives, and people asking, what's your bathroom like and what do you cook with and how many people are there anyway in this house? How much privacy, how much protection does a person have that information?
Okay. It's completely confidential. We want to assure the American public that information on the census form is confidential, and nobody but people in the Census Bureau can get that information.
Are we supposed to believe that?
Yes. It is protected under Title 13 of the United States Code.
There are severe penalties for violators of that trust. But for some people, no public service announcement or printed disclaimer on the census form will convince them that anything can deter the government from getting the information it wants. Convincing people otherwise, at least long enough to answer the questions, may be one of the most difficult problems faced by enumerators in the weeks ahead. The early count is expected to last 3 weeks for larger villages and 2 days for smaller settlements, weather permitting. You've been listening to Ruth Okitkin, Field Operations Assistant for the Interior and Arctic Slope Regions of Alaska for the 1980 U.S. Census. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. There it was, a blue two-door Chevy Nova parked in the back of the garage. No pinstriping or tuck and roll to set it off, but this was a car with a difference. A difference under the hood. The space where the engine should be had what looked like a 5-gallon gas can and lots of room around it. The owner and designer of this car with a difference is Don Luderbach of Fairbanks, recipient of a grant from the American Council on Science and Technology. Don, what makes this car so special?
Well, the thing about it is it's hydraulic driven, and we eliminated the large gas-guzzling engine.
When you say hydraulic driven, what does that mean?
I've eliminated the large engine and the drivetrain completely and installed a small air-cooled gas engine with a hydraulic pump, and then run hydraulic lines back to the rear wheels, and I'm driving it that way.
Luderbach's one-cylinder engine consumes 0.9 gallons of gas an hour, about 55 miles per gallon. He says altering a car to his hydraulic-powered system costs around $1,500 plus labor and doesn't affect the interior in any way. He cites few disadvantages to such a conversion. How about power, pickup, speed, that sort of thing?
I've been driving it around town and found that in town I can stay up with traffic. I don't have any problem getting away from a stop sign and staying right with the flow of traffic.
How about emissions from this kind of car?
Being that it only burns 0.9 gallons an hour, it's quite efficient, and therefore the emissions are negligible.
Well, a lot of people up here that have Volkswagens, for instance, which are air-cooled, can't drive them in the winter. Will this car be an exception?
Yes, because there is some features, some things you can do to an air-cooled engine to make it run in the wintertime in cold weather. This is an industrial engine like they use on water pumps, generators, and such in construction industry, and they run them all winter, so I'm sure that we won't have any problem. In fact, I know we don't have any problem with it.
Did you test it when we got to 40 below temperatures?
Yes, I did. I run it some in that, but I had some problem with my hydraulic drive, and therefore I didn't run it too very much.
I'm curious, really, about the winter applications. People with hydraulic floor jacks, for instance, sometimes have trouble with those also when it's very cold out.
We are utilizing aircraft hydraulic oil, which is made to run at the temperatures of 60 and 70 below on an airplane, and therefore we don't experience any problem with it.
How did you come up with an idea to change a car engine in this way?
Well, I work with hydraulics. Hydraulics is our main forte here, and also the air-cooled engines. And I've seen other applications, and over a period of years, I just... The idea evolved, and then I just finally went ahead and did it.
You got a grant to do this, is that right?
Yes, I had built the first car, and then I got a grant for improvements on it. There's a couple of improvements over the original model. We've installed an accumulator, which will actually store up hydraulic oil under pressure. This is built up by the rear wheels during deceleration, during the time you normally would have your brakes on or you're going down a hill. The rear wheels act as a motor driving the pump and build up and store this hydraulic oil so that when you go to start again, you have stored oil that doesn't require any additional energy to produce.
It all sounds kind of backyard high-tech, so I wondered if the average home mechanic could make the modifications, or at least the repairs.
Yes, it's not very difficult at all. The biggest problem actually is pulling the old engine out and clearing the way so you can put it in.
Is this the kind of thing that a person could learn to fix themselves, or is it one of those kinds of items that someone who's really a skilled hydraulic mechanic would have to do?
If the pump or the motor were to break down due to contamination or for some reason, or wear out eventually, probably a skilled mechanic would be required for that. However, the engine and the drive to and from the engine is very simple. It's not much more complicated than a lawnmower.
What are your next steps? You're going to be developing more prototypes of a hydraulic car?
Yes, my next step is to build a car right from the frame up. I want to come with a fiberglass body, aluminum frame, with this same drivetrain, and by doing that, I can increase my gear ratio, and I should hopefully hit 75 miles per gallon.
Are you planning on marketing this?
I don't have any plans in that direction at the present time. However, I've had a lot of people ask me about it, and I think there is a potential market, yes.
The Don Luderbach hydraulic special may be some years away, along with talk of a solo cylinder engine. Somehow there's more meat in phrases like straight six and V8. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
It's just impossible to enforce regulations where the economic incentive exists to circumvent those regulations.
The circumvented regulations that Alaska Department of Fish and Game marine mammals biologist John Burns refers to concern the sale of walrus ivory. Under the 1972 Marine Mammals Protection Act, raw, uncarved, unaltered walrus ivory may legally be sold or traded only between Alaska natives. But increasing amounts of walrus ivory are being introduced into the so-called black market. Non-native buyers will pay high prices for head mounts and tusks, encouraging illegal transactions between hunters and their intermediaries, and visitors seeking a material they cannot legally obtain. The ivory is often transported to outside markets, some U.S., others foreign, for carving. Often those carvings re-enter the market under the guise of genuine Alaskan native craft.
The carvers are becoming very concerned about the fact that a significant amount of ivory is going out of the regions where the carvers live, and it's being carved elsewhere and then coming back into the state to be sold in competition with locally produced carvings. And that's a reality that you can evaluate by going to any curio shop and looking at the kinds of curios that are for sale. One of the real complaints right now of the carving cooperatives is the fact that they're being underpriced by products from outside. We hear about connections from Alaska, for instance, to Hawaii, and from there there's no restriction on trade to really real important centers for ivory carving like Hong Kong. Whether it gets over there and how much gets there remains to be seen. Those kinds of products wouldn't come back into the state because that kind of carving is clearly recognizable as not being of local production.
Regardless of the style of the final carving, as more ivory leaves the state, partly due to decreasing sources for elephant ivory, there is less for Alaskan native carvers. Ronald Sanungatuk, an Eskimo artist born in the village of Wales on the Seward Peninsula, now teaches art at the Native Arts Center of the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. I asked him about the availability of ivory for native carvers.
I think most carvers have that problem. I know up north, ivory carvers are forever out of ivory.
There are several reasons for the lack of materials for native craftspersons. For one, carvers are not necessarily hunters themselves, even if they live in one of the coastal villages with access to the herds.
An ivory carver I know up north will sometimes become a very good ivory carver, mostly because he's not a very good hunter. See, the very good hunter occupies his time hunting and he's successful. And this guy wants to hunt, but he's not very successful. So what he turns to, you know, when he cannot get a janitorial job, is to become a fairly full-time ivory carver. That becomes his way of life. And then he depends on hunters and other people to for ivory source.
John Burns has spent much time in the Eskimo walrus hunting villages.
Given the economic incentive, are people killing walrus specifically for the ivory for sale?
Yes, it does happen, and it does happen in many places of Alaska. Now, no aspect of this issue can be painted with a broad brush. There are very concerned hunters in the villages who look upon walruses as vitally necessary to supply food, vitally necessary to supply byproducts such as skins for Eskimo skin boats, and equally important to provide a source of much-needed cash income. And if you look at the economic value of ivory, you have another whole spectrum. The person who takes the ivory that he has obtained from animals taken for subsistence purposes and maximizes the return by processing that ivory himself or herself into relatively high-value commodities and therefore maximizes the benefits to himself, herself, and their family. On the other hand, indeed, there are hunters who take walruses for food and don't carve, and they then have a surplus of raw material. And then it's an option as to whether they're going to go to the highest bidder, which may be a black market buyer, or to another ivory carver who just flat can't afford to pay an unreasonable price for the raw material that he needs.
The price paid for raw ivory is variable, as are the ways to obtain it. Ron Sanungatuk.
Sometimes there will be a peddler, say from St. Lawrence Island, and we'll come here with 15, 20 pounds. After a trip to Punuk Island in the summertime, he will come here needing some money, will come here knowing that we use this material. And he will come here, and we'll have pretty good chances, usually of getting pretty good material.
How much do they usually charge a pound?
It's negotiated. It's agreement between what this guy wants to sell and then what we want to pay it for. You know, it varies anywhere from, I think we have agreed very often on about $20 per pound. We also have some offers at 40, and we usually keep away from those.
But other people are willing to pay high prices for the ivory. Non-natives who have no legal way to obtain the material pay what the traffic will bear, sometimes in excess of $60 a pound, according to Burns. The effect of selling to the highest bidder ultimately impacts the carver. Without materials to carve and carved ivory re-entering the market as copies of genuine native craft, the carver is the loser, as is the person interested in purchasing fine quality work. Tomorrow we'll examine the impact of the illicit raw ivory trade on the native carver and the art buyer. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Ivory is one of those things that not only looks good, but it feels good. Ivory's a beautiful product, and I mean, it's a natural tusk just polished up is a beautiful thing. And of course, when an artist has worked on it and made it into something, it's even more attractive and appealing. And when people buy something like that, they have an object that represents an enormous amount of work and skill on someone's part. And
that's Dinah Larson, curator of ethnology at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks. The walrus ivory she talks about is in high demand by native carvers needing the material to work with and for outside markets, also for carving, but by people who are not Alaskan natives. These carvings often re-enter the market as items that appear to be native-made and are sold in direct competition with the real article. The loss of raw walrus ivory from the state limits productivity for local carvers, and the ersatz artifacts offered to buyers places an additional economic burden on native artisans. The illegal trade in raw walrus ivory has been building for some time, according to Alaska Department of Fish and Game marine mammals biologist John Burns. Prior to the 1972 passage of the Marine Mammals Protection Act, walrus were managed by the state. A permit was required to purchase raw ivory, and a 100-pound limitation was imposed. Now, federal law bans all sales of unaltered ivory to non-natives. As with any controlled substance, there are abusers. The extent is difficult to determine, though there have been arrests. Monitoring the harvest and use of ivory presents difficulties. Burns talks of potential conflicts in implementing controls.
The major goals, from as I see them, are one, to ensure so far as possible that raw ivory is channeled in the direction of the people that depend upon it most, i.e., the carvers in the remote areas, because alternate sources of income are very limited, and carving is a very good cottage industry. To do that and keep it at a reasonable price is, whether we like it or not, working to the disadvantage of the hunter who takes walruses for food and doesn't carve and wants to realize the maximum return from his ivory through selling it. He doesn't want to have an artificially depressed price. So no matter which way you approach the issue, somebody is going to be disadvantaged. The only major concern I think that we really all have to have is that people in fact are not disadvantaged as far as meeting their subsistence needs, and beyond that, that the walruses are in fact not disadvantaged because of excessive exploitation for ivory.
Balancing the needs of carvers, hunters, local economics, outside interests, and the walrus themselves leads to a situation that Eskimo artist Ronald Tanungatuk sums up this way.
This ivory business in Alaska is so rotten, it's way out of control. I mean, you talk about control, such as a ban around the ivory and so on, and then that little silver hand stamp on the ivory, all of those things are, as far as I'm concerned, are pretty useless.
The silver hand stamp, what Tanungatuk refers to, is a program started several years ago by Alaska's Division of Economic Enterprise. The idea is for Native artists or shop owners who display Native handicrafts to affix a small black stamp with a silver hand emblem to items, in effect guaranteeing their authenticity. The stickers can be obtained by writing or calling the office in Juneau. There are restrictions regarding the type of Native craft work that can bear the silver hand label. Fred Muller explains.
The product they produce has to be primarily manufactured by hand. There has to be quite a bit of handiwork involved in it.
According to Muller, a metal casting would probably not qualify, thereby excluding Native artists who work in jewelry, for example. The problem is one of definition. Is a piece of Native art less Native because non-traditional materials or methods are used? Manufacturer is the issue, not quality. Another problem, raised earlier by Tanungatuk, is one of control.
If a person writes or calls your office to obtain the stickers, what guarantee do you have that they're not affixing it to something that doesn't meet your requirements?
Well, in some respects, we don't. We're just not set up to police it that finitely. We have to depend upon the individuals themselves. The product they're producing is correct. Now, we do usually once every year and a half, run a survey on primarily gift shops that display Alaskan handicraft items in terms of primarily whether or not they're using the symbols.
If you do come across a business person who is affixing, say, the silver hand to outside-produced quasi-native items, is there any way to prosecute?
Now, there are regulations on the books, and there are, the state can prosecute if it finds abuses of the usage of these materials. We have not done it yet. We would prefer not to, if at all possible. In some cases, when we discover that the tags and stickers might be used incorrectly, what we attempt to do is work with the user to ascertain, number one, why they were used in the manner they were. And in many respects, it was done unintentionally, in which case the stickers and tags are removed and everybody is satisfied with the final outcome.
Everyone, that is, except the unsuspecting buyer who may have purchased what they thought was an Alaskan Eskimo carving, only to find out later, if at all, that the carving was not what it was represented to be. Knowing the difference between the real McCoy and an imitation is not always easy, says Curator Larson.
The confusion comes when a person walks into someplace and they're presented with this enormous range of choices, not all of which may be marked. One way of finding out is picking it up and looking at it, if it's possible. And if it's stamped Taiwan or Hong Kong on the bottom, you're not getting an Alaskan native piece. The elephant ivory products are found in many places. You find serving sets and salad forks and cake servers and so forth, and these are produced outside. The design on them was done by an Alaskan native Eskimo, but they're not hand carved. And the ivory used is elephant ivory, which is perfectly good ivory, but it's not walrus ivory, and it's not really what you expect to find in Alaska. Many of the things that you find made out of modern elephant ivory are quite white, I mean dead white. Ivory is often white, if it's a relatively new piece, but generally speaking, it has a little more mellow tone. But these are all things that you pick up over a long period of time, handling lots of different kinds of ivory.
Tanungatuk agrees that the average buyer is not likely to be able to tell what they're getting. It takes a lot of experience to know, and the silver hand is no guarantee.
You may sometimes see something that's very questionable, and it has that stamp. Again, that becomes meaningless. There isn't any guideline on how it should be used and when it should be used. We say we have it, but it seems so useless.
How could a person tell what they're getting?
You'd have to kind of, I think you'd have to become aware of ivory itself as a material, and then become aware of what kinds of trends there are as far as, if we can call it art style. There's certain style that goes on in St. Lawrence Island, certain style that goes on in Diomede, King Island, and in general Nome area, and a certain style in Wainwright. And these places have, each have their own peculiar kind of styles going on. And if you were to become aware of these activities, you would know difference between the one made in Seattle or in Taiwan or in Anchorage by some anonymous sweatshop operators. You would know the difference. There are a couple of people in Fairbanks who are not natives, and they're selling ivory carvings, and you can tell, even though they're really a lot of times trying to copy, you can still tell the difference. But that's learned process. If you're just general kind of a public person X, I don't think you could tell much difference.
It's general person X who is likely to enter a gift shop looking for something to send as a gift or take back home to display on the mantle. Few buyers are likely to have the expertise required to make a knowledgeable decision. The responsibility then rests on the shop owner or salesperson, and they also may lack the knowledge to know what they're selling, or they may not care. In my own experience, there is only one shop in Fairbanks, an art gallery, that does not display machine-made elephant ivory items next to hand-carved walrus ivory pieces. All of the others carry a mixture of genuine Alaskan Native art next to imitations, or work of questionable origin. Eskimo-made dolls may sit next to ones made in Korea without readily identifying labels. As in Roman times, it's still buyer beware. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Poor snow and trail conditions throughout the Midwest have hampered dog mushers in the major races outside the season. The three-day race in Saranac Lake, New York, scheduled for today through Sunday, may be canceled. And if it is, all mushers will be heading north to Alaska. Merv Hillpiper of Cedar Falls, Iowa, Harris Dunlap of Baker's Mills, New York, Peter Norberg of Ontario, Canada, Dr. Roland Lombard of Wayland, Massachusetts, and Dick Brunk of Fairbanks, all familiar names to Alaskan aficionados of the official state sport, are planning to travel from the Midwest Circuit to the Fur Rendezvous race in Anchorage next month.
Mush! Mush! Some night we're bound to find it, then on a golden sleigh forever we'll ride.
In only his third year of competing outside, Dick Brunk of Fairbanks is making good on his earlier claim that his team was in top form and he'd be giving other mushers a run for their money. He's placed in the top three finishers in all four races he's entered this season. Here are the race results for the Midwest Circuit. For the January 29th through 30th contest in Houghton, Michigan, 12 teams entered the unlimited class. First place went to Iowa's Merv Hillpiper, second to Dick Brunk, and third place to Peter Norberg, a young Eskimo from the Canadian village of Tuktoyaktuk. A race in Ashland, Wisconsin a few days later, January 5th and 6th, in which 11 teams competed in the open class had similar results. But this time, Norberg came out on top for first place, with Hillpiper dropping to second and Brunk picking up the third slot. Following that event, 13 teams entered the race in Bemidji, Minnesota, January 12th and 13th, with a repeat of the Ashland results. Norberg took first place, Hillpiper second, and Brunk picked up third. Ely, Minnesota brought one more musher into the limelight, as 16 teams entered the open competition January 19th and 20th. Merv Hillpiper picked up a first place finish this time, followed by Harris Dunlap, with Dick Brunk again coming in third. Right behind him, however, was Peter Norberg, followed by Charlie Stevens of Nenana and Dr. Roland Lombard rounding out the top six. With a competition this strong already, adding in the Alaskan winning teams of Roxy Woods, Gareth Wright, Harvey Drake, and George Atla should make for some very exciting races coming up in Alaska.
In the land of the pale blue snow, where it's 99 below, and the polar bears are roaming o'er the plain. In the shadow of the pole, I look plaster to my soul, we'll be happy when the ice worms nest again.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.